Good evening. My name is Paul Zales.
And my name is Lowell Yeager. Welcome to the 8th broadcast of Big Sky Radio, a 12-part series based on classic Montana literature.
Tonight we're going to be talking about Ivan Doig's This House of Sky, a memoir about itinerant ranch life during the middle part of the century. We'll also have an interview with Ivan later on in the show.
In the meantime, just to let our first-time listeners know who we are, this program is a call-in talk show funded by the Flathead County Library and the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Our phone number here at KOFI is 755-6690. We'll open the phone lines at the bottom of the hour. Also, remember, all the books discussed in this series are available at the Flathead County Library.
We also have a study guide, which has chapters on each of the books, along with questions for discussion. The study guides are kind of a Montana version of Cliff Notes. They're a good way for you to read about the basic issues raised in the books and a good way to participate in the discussion, even if you haven't read the books.
And of course, we don't expect all our listeners to have read all the books in the series, but we do hope this at least prompts people to take a look at Montana literature, to use our library system, and also, in terms of Big Sky Radio, to call us and talk about issues raised in the books.
But don't feel, though, that if you haven't read the books, that you can't call in. We've had all sorts of non-literary calls about family history, about reservation life, about what the authors were or weren't like, all kinds of calls, and we welcome them.
And we hope they keep coming. Big Sky Radio was envisioned not as just a show about books, but a show about Montana and Montanans and all that implies. Lowell and I are new at this radio format. We're learning as we go. I'm sure that's self-evident. But we also feel that we, and I'm sure our listeners, have been learning from those of you who have been calling in.
So keep teaching us, all of us here in the studio, and our listeners, and keep calling in. And while we're extending thank yous to our listeners, I'd like to say hello tonight to a couple of people who have told me they've been following our show and enjoying the discussion. I'd like to say hello to Max Swan, chairman of the English department at Polson High School, his wife Karen, and the young Swans. I know Mac has offered his students extra credit to listen to the show, and Mr. Swan told me his students have come into class the next day with interesting and enthusiastic comments. Also, hello to Kerry Cosner, who stopped me the other day in the aisle at Tidyman's to say he was listening to the show and reading the books. It's great to hear from our listeners. Surprising to know how many people out there are tuning in and how many people are visiting the library to check out our books and tapes. I'm also glad to know so many people are reading our study guide. Seems like wherever I go these days, everyone's talking about Big Sky Radio. Paul, didn't you tell me about taking some hides to be tanned?
Yeah, actually, I brought in a deer hide down to Hagel's Tannery, just south of downtown, which is this wonderful old barn of a building that looks as if it could have just as easily come out of the late 19th century. Anyway, when I went in the door and just started talking, one of the fellows there just said, "Paul Zales, Big Sky Radio," and we started talking about the radio show. It just really tickled me that these are the kind of people we're trying to reach, and we thank the Hagel brothers for listening, and it's just a sort of warm, reassuring feeling to know that the show isn't just appealing to sort of the college academic crowd, but a wide range of people. And it's one of the nice things about the program, about the way it was envisioned, and seems to be about the way it's working.
Yeah, I hope it's for everyone.
Okay, down to business. First, some background. Tonight we have a story about ranching and moving and making ends meet in rural Montana in the mid-20th century. What I'd like to do is pick up from last week, where we talked about boom and bust cycles, and begin tonight by talking about the land rush in Montana at the beginning of the century and how it established a pattern of sorts for life here for the rest of the century. To a great extent, at least in the beginning, it was the railroads that were behind the great Montana land rush. But there was one other key ingredient, water. Railroad advertisement hawked Montana as the last of the good states to be developed, and the government, both state and federal, made sure it happened because of the promise of water. At the turn of the century, settlers listened, and the last great agricultural land rush commenced in Montana, the same land rush that brought the Doig clan from Scotland and many of the other settlers to the Smith Valley, the valley where Ivan's father, Charlie Doig, said, Scotchmen and coyotes were the only ones that could live in the basin, and pretty damn soon the coyotes starved out. Previously, the 160 acres allowed by the government for homesteaders hadn't been enough because of scarce rainfall and at times near desert conditions. In 1909, following state and federal legislation that contributed money to promote irrigation and the development of what was called dry farming methods for soil moisture conservation, the Enlarged Homestead Act doubled the amount of federal land a person could settle and claim. And with that, the Montana land rush was on. To a great extent, as I said, behind all this were the railroads. The Milwaukee, Northern Pacific, and Great Northern spent huge sums to lure settlers to areas where they had laid track. And homesteaders came. They came by the thousands. Railroad companies offered what were the early century versions of Super Saver fares. For as little as $22.50, homesteaders could bring family, equipment, and livestock from St. Paul to Montana in a boxcar. In addition, railroads contributed thousands to aid in teaching farming techniques. They subsidized demonstration farms and promoted experts to travel the state to provide free agricultural advice. In no time, the sparsely settled eastern half of the state became a region dotted with homesteads, new towns, and counties. Coincidentally, it was during this time that large parts of the Flathead Reservation were open to homesteading. Montana had land to peddle, and peddle it did. From 1868, when the first homesteading claim was filed, to 1919, when the boom ended, settlers used federal laws to claim 32 million acres. In addition, the railroads sold land that had been granted them by the government. For example, during the great boom years of 1900 to 1917, the Northern Pacific sold 11 million acres, ranging in prices from $1.23 to $8.50 an acre. That's $8.50 an acre. At the height of it all, 1,000 claims went through the Great Falls Lands Office each month. In one evening alone, almost 250 settlers stepped off the train in Havre. When people came to the Smith River Valley, where a good part of tonight's book takes place, they came to a harsh country. As Doig writes, "The very floor of the Smith River Valley rests one full mile above sea level. Many of the homesteads were set into the foothills hundreds of feet above that. The cold, storm-making mountains climbed thousands of feet more into the clouds, bellying over the continental divide to the west. Whatever the prospects might seem in a dreamy look around, the settlers were trying a slab of lofty country, which often would be too cold and dry for their crops, too open to a killing winter for their cattle and sheep. It might take a bad winter or a late and rainless spring to bring out this fact, and the valley people did their best to live with calamity whenever it descended. But over time, the altitude and climate added up pitilessly, and even after a generation or so of trying the valley, a settling family might take account and find the most plentiful things around them still were sagebrush and wind." As Doig says, after those places, people did come, and as he suggests, they were coming after something of an illusory promise. People were after land, for the most part free of charge, land that railroad and other promoters promised was farmable with plenty of water. Water. As we said, the underlying and most essential factor in development. Follow the history of water, and you follow the history of the West. It was water, or the lack of it, that burst the land boom. During the early years of World War I, wheat prices were trading at all-time highs, but by 1917, the rain stopped falling. During 1917, eastern Montana communities received a quarter to a third of what their normal rainfall was, and normal rainfall had always been just enough to maintain crops. The Montana Agricultural Experiment Station reported the worst drought conditions on record. To make things even worse, a plague of locusts struck. Whatever crops survived the drought, the grasshoppers ate. A year later, World War I ended. The price of wheat took a nosedive, and depression swept across the Montana prairies. The legislature met in special session and dealt with the state as a disaster area. Still, the rain didn't fall. Farms and ranches failed. Banks foreclosed on them, but they couldn't sell the property, and then, too, the banks failed. While the rest of the country was knee-deep in the roaring 20s, Montanans were having an early taste of what was to come in the 1930s. Between 1920 and 25, nearly 200 banks failed in Montana. Everything went sour, and what had been a rush for land in Montana became an exodus. Census figures estimate that between 70 and 80,000 people flooded into eastern and central Montana between 1909 and 1918, and 60,000 of them left before 1922. But not the Doig clan, despite what they were up against. As Ivan writes in This House of Sky, simply, it came down to this. Homesteads of 160 acres, or even several times that size, made no sense in that vast and dry and belligerent landscape of the high mountain west. As well try to grow an orchard in a window box as to build a working ranch from such a patch. Even if you somehow outlasted the weather, then no foothills homestead you built for yourself could head off a future of national forest boundaries and powerful livestock companies. Like much else in the wrestling of this continent, the homestead laws were working to a result, right enough, but not to the one professed for them. The homestead sites my father could point out to me by the dozen, place upon place, and our own family soil among them, in almost all cases turned out to be not the seed acres for yeoman farms amid the sage, nor the first pastures of tidy family ranches. Not that at all. They turned out to be landing sites, quarters to hold people until they were able to scramble away to somewhere else. Quarters, it could be said, that did for that region of rural America what the tenements of the immigrant ghettos did for city America. As it turned out, that's exactly what it did for Ivan Doig. He lived that life. He came two generations down from homesteaders. His father worked ranches up and down Montana, and so did Ivan. They lived a life of ranches, strong women, small towns, and bars. They lived a tough, grueling life, surviving one crisis only to confront another. But then Ivan moved on. He moved on for what would be for him a better life. He moved on to college out of state, the first ever from his high school, then a life in journalism, academia, and writing, and a home in a large city, Seattle. It's a success story and a story of moving away, of moving from the West his father knew, but he moved on to an easier life without forgetting his former life, as he says at the end of This House of Sky. For another, my father stayed in the moments of my days steadily now, even as his body dwindled from me. All of his way of life that I had sought escape from, the grindstone routine of ranching, the existence at the mercy of mauling weather, the endless starting over from one calamity or another, was passing with him. And while I still wanted my distance from such a gauntlet, I found that I did not want my knowing of it to go from me. The perseverance to have lasted nearly 70 years amid such cold prospects was what heritage Dad had for me. I had begun to see that it counted for much. Ivan Doig, This House of Sky.
Okay, Paul. Well, we've been looking in this series to trace the various stories, the various ways of life common in Montana. We've talked about early mountain men, the early traders, the homesteaders, and we've talked for three shows about the Native Americans who were in this area before any of the rest of us arrived. Last week we talked about Richard Hugo. His story is common to many of us because he moved here in his 40s, feeling disconnected and still searching for a place he could call home. Like many of us, Hugo was a newcomer to Montana, an immigrant. Hugo adopts Montana as his place or his home. It's this sense of place, this sense of home, that Ivan Doig in This House of Sky so well describes. So this book is a further piece to the puzzle or the mosaic of lives that characterize us in Montana. This is the story of growing up in the small towns and ranching communities east of the divide. It's a story, as you said, Paul, that began with the early cattle boom days in the late 1800s when people like Nanny Alderson and her husband ventured westward to make a living off the land, an agrarian lifestyle, raising livestock or planting crops. But Ivan Doig's tale is two generations removed from the Aldersons, and there are some important differences. First, where the Aldersons never planned to stay in Montana. If you remember, they had come to profit by the cattle boom and then hoped to move back east and live off their earnings. Charlie Doig, on the other hand, and his ancestors had come to stay. They were, as Nanny Alderson said, quote, pioneering in earnest, unquote. Secondly, Ivan Doig and his father are not immigrants to Montana. They were born here. They are not striking out from someplace else to try to make a life for themselves on a foreign frontier. They are sticking it out in the place they had come to know and love as home. So this is the post-agrarian boom and bust frontier. These are the people that Hugo loves so well, the tough ones who hang on despite great odds against them, the people whose lives begin to resemble the landscape in its ruggedness and its bedrock reality. These are the people Hugo would have called, you know, remember what he said, the alders and the catfish, meaning these people should be admired for their tenacity and endurance. And these people are survivors. They are the people that Hugo said could, in that wonderful line on Hugo's tombstone from Glenn Ewig, people who could eat stone and go on if they had to. Bill Beavis, University of Montana, points out that the most common immigrant experience in Montana is a cycle of illusion, then disillusionment, and then finally endurance. Illusion, meaning people come here with big dreams. Disillusion, meaning that soon the bubbles of those dreams are burst upon the jagged realities of day-to-day life in a place like this. And finally, endurance, meaning that those who do stay, who decide to stick it out, exhibit this special quality of the alder or the catfish, the ability to hang on, as does Charlie Doig, in spite of, as Ivan so simply puts it, grinding routine and endless starting over. I love that moment in the book when Doig, you mentioned that, Paul, when Doig is talking about the first settlers in the Smith River Valley, and he says Scotchmen and coyotes was the only ones that could live in the basement, and pretty soon the damn coyotes starved out. I think that's a wonderful way of looking at it. The tenacity of those people were like coyotes, I think, in so many ways. So these are the children, then, of the immigrants, the new native Montanans. And there is much to be admired of what they have learned from the hard lives of their ancestors. That's what Ivan Doig is doing here most of all. He's writing in praise and appreciation for his father, Charlie Doig, and for his grandmother, Bessie Ringer. So endurance is one thing that characterizes these people's lives, but there's two other huge factors: land and family. What makes this book so enjoyable for so many readers is Doig's lyrical depictions of the landscape. He's ever conscious of the great span of mountain ranges surrounding whatever valley he's inhabiting. The land itself is his home. I always felt when I was reading the book that even when Doig was describing himself being on the couch sleeping one night in someone else's home somewhere in central Montana, I'm always conscious of the wind blowing outside or the stars in the sky and the mountain ranges in the distance. And there's just something about the way Doig writes that makes me aware of the land always around us. But this is not the same land, the same frontier that Boone Caudill in the Big Sky inhabited. Boone romanticized this place as his personal paradise, and he very egotistically projected fantasies of his own beauty and prowess onto his surroundings. He fancied himself to be an Indian, but he was very white, very European in the way that he appropriated his surroundings. He had come to take the land, maybe you could even say rape the land, but his connection to the land was no greater than his connection to his squaw, Teal Eye. He seemed to see Teal Eye as no more than an extension of his own ego, and he sees the land, I'd bet, in the same way. But not so for the Doigs. These are people who, in a very Indian way, are nurtured by the land. They feel a kinship toward it. True, they are still very European in their need to master and dominate, but those drives seem to have been softened over the generations to where now Ivan can call the place this house of sky, as if the sky itself were a sheltering roof over the valley floors in which he was raised and feels connected in the ways Richard Hugo longed for. It's interesting how Doig describes this sense of place. He says, where is it, page 22, quote, "Anyone of Dad's generation always talked of a piece of land where some worn-out family had eventually lost to weather or market prices, not as a farm or a ranch or even a homestead, but as a place," end quote. So we've got here in this book the story of a very tenacious people who endure life in a hard place. How do they do it? I think most of all, for me, this book teaches me about family. Teaches me that one way to endure in a hard place like Montana is to endure it together with family. Doig's family, of course, was not the traditional beaver cleaver sort of family. Doig's earliest years are spent in isolated sheep camps and migrating with the flocks. Doig's mother dies of asthma as a result of the difficulties of this rugged lifestyle, leaving her six-year-old and his father to learn the rhythms of their own peculiar bonding. By current standards, the reader might view young Ivan as an abused child, even. His father spends many nights in the local saloon, leaving his son outside curled up in the seat of the pickup, trying to sleep and keep warm until his father is ready to go home. Also, the young Doig changes homes and schools far more often than most parents would consider healthy, even. And he's forever, as they say, boarding out with relatives or strangers for long stretches of time. And the boy seems to have alarmingly few close friends, no playmates at all, as far as I could see in the book, and no family other than his father and grandmother. But it's much too easy to judge, I think, the inner life of this boy by looking at the outer circumstances. This book argues eloquently for the reader to open his or her mind to the many different possible configurations of the family. Doig calls his family, which was himself, his father, and his grandmother, a brink of a family. And Doig does not fall into sentimentality by romanticizing his family for more than what it is. He very willingly shows the entire picture, including the interminable wrangling between his father and grandmother. Then he also shows us the other side, how these three survivors, these native Montanans, endured here, and in the end, how they stuck together, how they bonded in love and commitment to each other. It'll be interesting to consider again how Doig's family, with all its handicaps and hardships, works so well, especially in contrast to the family that we'll be looking at in the book A River Runs Through It in a couple weeks from now. That family, though it's a much more traditional family and looks much better from the outside, seems much less successful in matters of the heart than does Doig's family.
When you think about this family, you've got Ivan as a product of, there's, let's say, one death in the family, then there's a divorce, and then a father sort of with great difficulty living with his mother-in-law. This certainly wasn't your, you know, squeaky clean, ideal family, but it was filled with this tightness that just permeates the whole book.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about this book is that it is a book about family, and so often when I hear people talk about this book, what they dwell on is, oh, what beautiful writing, or, oh, what a wonderful landscape. But there's something remarkable and just very, very worthwhile to look at in Doig's family situation. How he felt so loved, mm-hmm. How he felt cared for through all of that is more than I can understand.
You know, part of that, I think, may be the fact that he was kind of like the adhesive for, I mean, he's like the glue for these people. I think if he wasn't around, I couldn't imagine Charlie Doig living with his mother-in-law. I mean, it was because of Ivan that they were together. And then later on, for us, it's because of Ivan Doig writing this book that he sort of puts all of this together. In a way, he is in the living experience, and he is in the reflection, the binding force behind that.
Yeah, you know, we were talking in class about how this strange configuration of a family still seemed to work, and one of the things that we concluded was that although Charlie was an inarticulate man in a lot of ways and ill-equipped in a lot of ways to be the father that we would normally think of, you know, because here's his grandmother who plays ball with this boy, here's the grandmother who finally wrestles with this boy, Charlie's off somewhere else working or something. After all of that, he doesn't look like he's going to be a very successful father figure, but there is something he must project to the boy, a sense of security and acceptance and a sense of worth worthwhile, that he makes Ivan feel worthwhile in the world somehow, that is just, Ivan's rock. His rock is support.
He is, and through that all, the other thing that was interesting about Ivan, you touched on it, was this aloneness that he had. I think early on in the book when he, just after his mother died and they decided to move into town so he can get some schooling, he remarked how he was giving up his aloneness, which was so important to him. And he doesn't rediscover that, it doesn't seem, until later on in the book when he meets and has as a mentor Mrs. Tidyman, who kind of opens up the world of books to him. And he's back into his aloneness, but it's this connected aloneness.
Yeah, reading is that sort of comfortable isolation that he enjoyed. Solitude, I think, is a better word than isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let's go to our interview now with Ivan Doig. If those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Big Sky Radio on KOFI. We're talking with Ivan Doig from his home in Seattle. We're discussing tonight this House of Sky. Ivan, if we can start off with, if we could begin maybe where and when, if you could tell us where and when you actually started writing this House of Sky, what impelled you to write it, how the book kind of got on its feet.
That would be in the late 60s and early 70s, Paul. My father and grandmother were still living in White Sulphur Springs, Montana. My dad was slowly dying of emphysema. And so my wife Carol and I were back to Montana quite a lot, trying to help my folks deal with that situation. And on one of those trips, I brought along a shiny new tape recorder. I was a graduate student in history at the University of Washington at the time, and thought I would like to do an article on White Sulphur Springs' famous singer of Negro spiritual, Taylor Gordon. And so there in summer of 1968...
He was still alive then?
He was still alive then. He died just a year or so after that, Paul. And to shorten the story, Taylor couldn't see me for a day or so, and so there I sat with these new reels of tape and thought, well, maybe it's time I got some of the family stories down. And so that proved to be the last time that my dad really had the air and energy to tell some of his stories. And my grandmother outlived him a few years, and so I had other sessions with her. Out of those voices of the talking with the people in White Sulphur Springs, as well as my own family, came a growing determination that a book about that generation of Westerners, and specifically, as it turns out, of Montanans, was something I desperately wanted to write.
And in writing that, what seemed to happen is, there was a very individual, very different kind of Western voice that you managed to craft. I noticed in that, I read it a few years ago when I first moved to Montana and reread it again this past week. There's a sense, especially in the first part of the book, that your sentences are almost like, they're almost like chiseled. They're so finely wrought. They're just beautifully written. What was it like? I mean, did you work really hard at that? Was there was almost a poetic sense to your prose?
Yes, Paul. There's a deliberate chiseled is a pretty good word. A poetically chiseled sense about this House of Sky. I've long kept a diary and journals on writing and so on, and tucked away in one of those is thinking out loud on the paper to myself, I guess, that if I possibly could, I'd like every sentence of this House of Sky to have a trap of poetry in it. And so I worked and reworked the language of that book, probably say the opening paragraph, which is maybe the most famous portion of the book. I probably wrote that 75 times.
Uh-huh.
5 or 6 years, Paul.
Now you're an accomplished, well-known writer, but all this, how did you make that decision to finally finally leave Montana and leave that life. I know that there's this the wonderful scene in the book where you're up on the Blackfeet Reservation and there's that summer storm and the sheep are stampeding, and you, once it's all over with, you come up with what seems to be a realization that this life isn't for you. Could you maybe talk a little bit more about that, about why you left Montana, why you kind of left in a way a mythic father and a very Western lifestyle?
In spring of 1963, I came back to Ringling, Montana, after having completed college and having been through my stint in the Air Force. And so I lit into Ringling with $2 in my pocket, both of them borrowed from a friend in Chicago. My dad then had this disease. We were just learning even to spell. We'd never heard of emphysema before. My grandmother was still vigorous, but getting on into her 70s, she couldn't be a ranch cook forever. The house in Ringling is about the size probably of the studio you're talking from, Paul. Small, three-room, railroad shotgun shanty. You could fire a shotgun through the all three doors and go out the back window of a place.
It sounds
like
kind of like the studio.
Looking around there, it dawned on me pretty rapidly that somebody in this family had better get out and try and get a real living wage into the family. And so I turned back east, in Illinois, as my dad always called it, took a newspaper job that was offered to me in Decatur, Illinois, and that really started me in the kind of professional climbing I wanted. There was no land base for me in Montana, very little economic base, really. And it should be pointed out, too, that my background was in journalism. My training was in a school of journalism at Northwestern University. And up until the time I was about out of college, all the daily newspapers of any size in Montana, except for the Great Falls Tribune, were still owned by the Anaconda Company. I believe it was on all of our minds that we did not want to embark on our professional careers in these company town newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And so out we went into a bigger world as we saw it. And I think in all three cases, it did prove to be a bigger world for our words and ambitions. And after we had made our way and shouldered some family obligations, then we were able to turn back and do our writing about Montana.
Right. If I could throw you back to Montana history and how it affected natural history and how it affected your family. That winter back in 1919-20, when the one that really seemed to kind of sock it to the Doi clan, it seemed at that point you were on the verge of kind of making it big in the homestead. If that winter didn't happen, would your dad's life have changed? Would your life have changed? Would you, and I suspect not for you, but maybe at least for your father, that maybe the Doi homestead would have survived and been something of a prosperous ranch.
There is a chance there. You're right, Paul. A kind of a cog jumps in the natural world there in the winter of 19, and a lot is determined, which maybe would not have been determined as rapidly, at least. The Depression followed on and hit people such as the Doigs very heavily in Montana. But certainly it was the winter of 19 and the drought that had been accompanying there for a few years, which brought homesteads such as my grandparents to their knees very rapidly. But that proved to be a repeating pattern.
Right.
My father's life, Paul, that about the time he would have it made, as we said, in the sheep business or running some cattle, or even one year when he planted an enormously promising-look crop of seed peas outside of outside of White Sulphur Springs. He would get to the brink, and then some disastrous weather would happen. The pea crop got snowed on after he made his first round with the combine, for instance. And until 1919 was simply the biggest of these kind of concentric rings of weather problems.
It doesn't seem to be, obviously, an isolated circumstance of bad luck either. I mean, we, in our radio series, are talking, it's about Montana literature, and it's about Montana, and it's just kind of a continuing refrain here that people are at the mercy of the landscape, at the mercy of weather, at the vagaries of these tremendous forces outside of their lives, and it's how they cope with them that makes these wonderful stories such as yours.
That is certainly one thing I believe I read written for me in the Weather of the Big Skies of Montana, Paul, was that if I stayed and tried an agricultural life of some sort, and until I was probably a sophomore, at least in high school, I figured I probably would, I was going to be at the mercy of the weather, that two generations of pretty hardworking people before me had tried that, and we simply didn't have pockets deep enough to last through it. And so off I went into a gamble of its own, but at least one that won't freeze the toes off writing.
All of us are surely glad you did. I want to pass the phone on to Lowell. He's got a couple questions he wanted to ask you.
Fine.
Hi, Ben.
Hello.
A real beautiful book you wrote there.
Thanks very much.
I wanted to ask you, last week we talked about Richard Hugo's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he does a lot with a sense of place. He kind of didn't have a sense of place for most of his life. Ironically, he was raised near where you're living now and then moved out here. But you seem to have had a sense of place from day one. How has that affected your life?
Well, it has certainly stayed between my ears, I think, Lowell, as I have written now seven books, and I guess five of them take place either around the Big Belt country where I was born or the Rocky Mountain front where I grew up. I think that family such as mine, and in my new book, Hard Earth, I'm trying to explore this from my mother's point of view. Families such as mine maybe didn't have much else in their lives except a sense of place.
Well, there seem to be so many kids in Montana today, even when I speak at high schools and things like that, who can talk about nothing but leaving. And, you know, I don't see a hint of that in your story there until later on in life.
In those days, it took us a while to realize what the ladders ahead could be. World War II did it automatically for a generation before mine, I think, Lowell, that so many people, some women as well as men, were put out into the world by the war, and either through serving in the military or in defense work someplace, they made their turns elsewhere from Montana. But my generation, my high school class of 20 from Valier, by and large, still lives in Montana. Only I think three or four of us have gone out of state. And mine was, I guess, by considerable, the most years accumulated in college classrooms. But even so, I'm within an easy day's drive of your microphone.
And it seems like your mind has never left your imagination.
Mind has never left, yeah. I think. I've always hearkened to James Joyce along those lines, trying to figure out how to answer that question. Well, you know, why did you ever leave Montana? And let's ask of Joyce, who, of course, wrote Ulysses, the great Dublin novel, while he lived in Paris. He always said, "Have I ever left?"
question I'm just dying to ask you is, I was raised in the Midwest and in a much more traditional family than yours, and yet, as I read your book, I can't believe that my family ever reached the depths of closeness that you and your father and your grandmother did. How on earth did you guys pull that off?
Well, a lot of it is simply, I don't know what you'd say, endurance, perseverance, doggedness, that we were never aware that we should do anything other than hunker in and put up with each other.
Uh-huh.
And there were some releases provided by the outdoors, I guess, and I found it in books. And so there were, I think, just enough release valves in our lives that we could catch our breath and then say, okay, three of us are going to live in this trailer house about the size of the back end of a pickup for the rest of the summer, and we may not like it, but it probably won't kill us.
Well, that attitude is really in the book. I don't see you pitying yourself any time. I mean, I think one of the most touching scenes to me is where you're waiting outside the bar for your dad, and you're sleeping on the front seat of the pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, even in rendering that scene, there isn't a hint of blame on your dad. There isn't a hint of self-pity.
Yeah, I certainly hope not. I was asked out on the bookstore trail, as I've been this fall for Hard Earth, someone asked me, didn't I resent my dad for that? And I said, my God, no. I thought, as it turns out, that was a marvelous training for what I've ended up doing in life, of having that early ticket into the adult world, of being able to hear what they were talking about, seeing people on into the night when they often get the most interesting.
So you felt cared for?
Yes, I did. I don't know what jargon would apply today, but downtown Lancaster Springs, I don't know if you could call it an extended family, but it was certainly some kind of a community if you were, you know, an independent enough kid, if you had your feet under you, and watched what was going on and didn't pooch out your lower lip and feel sorry for yourself.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ivan. I also just wanted to thank you for the wisecrack in the book about getting a meal on account of being broke.
All right,
I'm for sure going to use that.
Okay,
here's
good.
Paul again. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're running out of time here. I have one last question for our listeners. Could you talk a little bit about your new book, Good Earth, Hard Earth, excuse me, and how what its relationship is to This House of Sky?
Hard Earth, Paul, turned out to be an unexpected cousin, I guess, to This House of Sky. In writing This House of Sky, I couldn't come up with any correspondence of my mother's. And as you know from the opening of This House of Sky, she went out of the family picture in mid-1945 when I was six. And so when my Uncle Wally Ringer died a few years ago in Montana and left me my mother's letters to him when he was on a destroyer in the South Pacific in 1944 and 5, here all of a sudden was my mother's voice on paper, indications of what was on her mind there just before This House of Sky begins and so on. And so it gave me a chance to, mm-hmm. as I say in the book, deliberately dream back into that earlier period.
Well, we understand that's all out in the bookstores, and we look forward to reading that. I think even the library's got a copy on order. Well, thank you very much, Ivan, for your time. If you can hang on the phone here after we cut off the interview, we want to talk to you a little bit more. Both Lowell and I appreciate your taking the time out of a busy afternoon to speak with us. As I think there's a scene in the book where you talk about one of the bartenders, and I guess it's a stockman in White Sulphur Springs, talking one of the finest accolades he could render was, I think it was Pete McCabe who said that, oh, you know, we talk about the fellow down the end of the bar as being a good guy. You certainly are a good guy. Whenever your name comes up with people around here or down in Missoula, it's always, well, he's a really nice fellow, and it's
certainly self-evident talking with you on the phone. We thank
you
very much.
Thanks very much. I appreciate you guys pitching in on Montana literature here. I think it's pretty good stuff for all of us to be waiting around in.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Okay, we are back live at the studio, KUFI. Our phone number, for those of you who would like to call in, is 755-6690.
He was a nice guy.
He was a delightful person to talk to. I wish we could have gone on for another half hour with him.
Maybe we should get him live in Missoula.
I hope so.
Bring him into the studio.
Okay, we've got a phone call from Kalispell, line one. Ball's going to hit it.
Hello, Kalispell.
Hi, my name is Kristen Kaufman.
Hi, Kristen.
I wanted to make a comment on the show.
Sure. Be kind.
that I think that if people listen to the show, they'll want to check out books in the library, and then they want to get more into the history, and then thinking it's just boring.
Great, yeah. Are you like that? You're reading these books?
Well, kind of, yeah.
Good. Now, you live in Kalispell, huh?
Uh-huh.
Where do you go to school?
Helena Flats.
Did you call us before?
No, that was Cindy.
Oh, that was your friend. Hey, Paul wants to talk to you a moment.
Do you think history's boring?
Not really. It's kind of interesting on the different lifestyles.
What do you like about it? What's your favorite period?
I'm not really sure.
Well, I sure want to thank you for calling. I'm really glad to hear you're listening. Tell Cindy to keep listening, too.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Good night now.
She was kind, but earlier this evening, apparently we did have a critical call from a Montanan who told us we were not true Montanans because we didn't know how to pronounce coyote. I'm going to blow it. We didn't pronounce coyotes right. We were saying coyotes.
Yeah, well, I speak coyote.
Okay, we've got another call coming in from on line two. From Ferndale.
Hello.
Hello, Ferndale. Are you there?
Yes, hi.
This is Big Sky Radio. You're live on the air.
Okay, I just have kind of a technical question about this book. On the back, it's labeled a memoir, and I don't know what the difference between a memoir and an autobiography is. And along that same line, more with the content, is when an author is writing an autobiography or a memoir like this, how do they get away with not being sued for libel or slander, whatever the legal word is?
First question, the difference between an autobiography and a memoir. An autobiography, you really got to trace, you got to be comprehensive. You know, I was born in Missoula in 1942, and my dad did this, my mom did this, and you sort of have to run through the whole gamut. Memoirs tend to give you a lot more flexibility, having knocked one off myself. It allows you the chance to sort of take sort of glancing, circuitous routes around stories about your life. You're still tied to telling the truth, to telling what you experienced and what you remember. But I guess that's actually another key aspect of it. It's what you remember, or at least try to remember. It doesn't, sometimes there's a little bit of a looseness about that with an autobiography. You've often, I mean, you're telling it first person, but you should make sure and get absolutely sure that you know, the reality you are remembering is exactly right. That doesn't necessarily have to be with a memoir. Sometimes the reality is the way we remember it, the way we perceived it, the way we put our stories back together again. And I'm sorry, I forgot what was your second question.
Libel and slander.
Basically, and as I taught in my journalism classes, your ultimate defense is truth. If in your memory you tell you depict somebody, you tell a story, whatever, as best to the best of your ability, as you remember it as being true. Usually, truth as is a defense if you are somehow called into court for libel. The other thing, usually people don't use books, although I should, as I'm saying this and thinking it, I'm thinking to myself of all the celebrity books that are out now and how people use them kind of to
slam somebody.
You're right, exactly. Yeah. But what the way they get away with that is because that they are dealing with celebrities who operate in the public theater, and when you become a celebrity, you kind of lose a lot of rights of privacy here, and the way at least the Constitution applies to public figures. Hopefully that answers your question a little bit.
Yeah, I was just thinking like the character of the school teacher or some of the descriptions of the people in the bars, you know, if there was any concern of them coming back at the author.
I suppose that they could, you know, and say that, oh, God, I didn't have two drinks that night, I only had one, or something like that. But then there's no way they would prove it. And
I always have this small dream that I'll be reading through a book, and then suddenly I'll find myself there sitting at the bar or something, and the author will have been there and found me, you know. I'd probably pay them to do that, let alone sue them.
Well, thank you for the call. Those were interesting points to bring up. Appreciate
it.
Okay, again, this is Big Sky Radio. Our phone number here in the studio is 755-6690. You know, Lowell, in your talk about the book, one of the things you mentioned was the power of landscape and the power of land, which a lot of people talk about with this book. When I first came here 4 years or so ago, one of my students, I wanted to read things written by Montanans, and wanted to learn about Montana literature. And one of my students said the first book I should try was This House of Sky, which at spring break that year I did. Barbara and I went to Florida to visit her father, and amidst the sand and swaying palms, I read about the Smith River Valley and the Blackfeet Reservation. And it had this weird effect, not weird, it had this sort of compelling effect to me, like I realized that I was beginning to get myself attached to a place. I was in Florida, but I was also experiencing Montana and being proud that, God, this is where I live now. Now, this time, this past week, as I reread it, when he talks about the Smith Valley, when he talks about the Blackfeet Reservation, when he talks about crags and buttes and high plains and sage, I've spent some time now in the eastern part of the state, and I'm beginning to know this the way someone might know their home, the way someone knows pictures in a photo album. I recognize these places now, and there's almost a kind of tactile sense as he's describing them. Now it's not just sort of the novelty of where I live. It is truly where I live. There's almost topography to that language in there. It's to me much more. It's richer and it's powerful. It's really kind of binding.
Mm-hmm. But you know, sometimes I distrust descriptions of landscape alone. I'll never forget reading William Kittredge's Owning It All, mm-hmm. about ranching in eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. And during one spring break, I drove to the places that he mentioned in eastern Oregon, because in the book they were all delicious. They were wonderful, beautiful, live places. And I just couldn't find anything but a pile of rocks. You know, it was just all barren rocks.
But that was one thing that was really different about this book. This was not a romantic depiction of Montana.
Yeah, well, neither was Kittredge's. But the other thing is that last spring I went over to White Sulphur after I'd read this book, and I did feel something different there. I mean, I think we do as Montanans feel a kind of, we see a beauty, we see a connectedness here that has a lot to do with that endurance and decision to stick it out. I think that a lot of Montanans take pride in. And I've kind of made that decision for myself, too. You also?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is one of the things that somehow binds all of us. When we first came here, and actually not the last couple of years, we have a neighbor who's in the construction business talking about all the new people moving in, and he keeps saying, well, the winter's eventually going to scare them away. That really is the ultimate litmus test.
Yeah.
You can't come here expecting an easy life. There is a leveling force out there.
Yeah, but you can come here expecting lots of life.
We've got, before we go to this next call, just a reminder to other potential callers, our number here in the studio is 755-6690. Okay, line one, Columbia Falls.
Hi, you're on Big Sky Radio.
Yes, sir. See, I was just kind of curious. How do you think that Ivan and Charlie's relationship would have differed if Ivan's mother had lived?
Well, that's a really interesting question. How do you think it might have differed?
Well, I thought they had a pretty good relationship, father and son relationship, and I don't know how the mother would have come into play in that, and that's kind of why I was calling to ask you the question.
Well, I know there's something really magical about how
You know, Ivan talks about his father taking him in as an equal. You know, right away, 6 years old, and he takes him out on the job with him every day. He goes out, you know, mending fences or herding sheep or whatever they do. And at night, he goes, takes him to the bar. And, you know, you just heard Ivan in the interview saying that, you know, well, that was a kind of wonderful early education for him into the realities of life. So, you know, there's some sort of wonderful bond there between Ivan and Charlie. And I really wish I could understand it. I mean, I have kids myself, and whatever it is, the way Charlie treats Ivan works. You know, somehow, maybe Charlie just gives him, treats him in a basic human way that makes him feel worthwhile and valuable.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me is that Ivan ends up taking what would have been the more, at that time, maybe feminist kind of direction. I mean, he ended up going towards, instead of following in his father's footsteps, he was into literature and school and academia.
Yeah, his grandmother's influence partly.
And Mrs. Tidyman.
Mrs. Tidyman, yeah.
He didn't follow in his he admired him like hell, but he went in the other direction.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of interesting that the women that he did that were involved in his life did play important parts.
They played incredibly powerful parts, and you know, they were sort of the subtext, I thought, to the whole book. It was, in the end, it was he went in the direction that the women pointed him. I found, and I mean, he didn't follow in his father's footsteps. He rejected that.
Yeah, Bessie Ringer, you know, is you know, we always say strong woman. Well, she's strong by any gender. You know, I love the scene where she's wrestling with Ivan. Ivan says he plays baseball with her, and she will even wrestle. Well, I think she could probably out-wrestle most of us, you know. Thank you for calling. We're going to take another call here.
All right,
Ivan.
My name is Lowell.
One of the fortunes of my life is I had a grandmother like that who played ball with me, and we wrestled, and it was a wonderful thing to have.
Okay, call on line 3. Hello, you're on Big Sky Radio?
I turned your radio down.
Can you turn
your radio down in the background? We're getting some feedback. Hi, this is Whitefish, right?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, I
can hear you. Okay. You're live on the air.
I'm running for the radio, sorry.
That's okay.
I found it interesting that Ivan writes about being in the bar scene at a young age with his father. And it's something that a lot of people have probably had to do in their lives with their fathers in Montana, I would bet you. And he says that it's okay, that it was kind of an interesting way to grow up and be a part of. And we've got a lot of people today that think it's really bad to probably take your kids around into a bar.
The book, the whole book makes me want to not make such snap, easy judgments about parental relationships. I mean, It makes me see that there's an inner experience that's more important than the outer experience, and whatever was going on for Ivan was a good inner experience, even though the outer circumstances looked pretty rough. We're going to have to take another call, line. Thank you very much for calling.
Bye.
Actually, it's not another call. What we have to do is cut off from here because we're at the end of our hour. Again, this brings us to the close of another hour of Big Sky Radio. Next week, we'll be discussing James Welch's Winter in the Blood. And, well, we're going to have Jim on the line?
Yeah, we're going to have Jim live with us next week, I hope. And he should have some interesting things to say for Winter in the Blood. And we'll interview him and
See where we go from there. For tonight, and always, thanks again to the Flathead County Library and staff and Project Director Joyce Johnson, Big Sky Radio Administrative Assistant Julie Leggett, KOFI Station Engineer Ron Hirsch, Ivan Doig for his phone interview, and of course, the National Endowment for the Humanities, who make this show possible each week.
My name is Lowell Yeager. Paul, I was wondering if I could tell him that's really me on that flute in the music.
Yeah, we've had some people ask us about the our theme music. If, for those of you who are interested, it's James DeMar's The Spirit Horses, accompanied by Lowell.
My name is Lowell Yeager. Thanks for joining Big Sky Radio tonight.
And my name is Paul Zales. We hope to talk with you again next week. Good night.
This is 1180 AM Stereo KOFI, Kalispell, Whitefish, Columbia Falls, 9 o'clock. Mutual News coming up next.